Are you one of our regular students for Self-Improvement Wednesday? Each week you get to learn something new, and each week you get to test out what you've learnt on our website, where there's already a pop-up test all about today's lesson. Your lesson this week, the New South Wales experience of the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918-1919. Your teacher is Jeremy McAnulty, the Director of Communicable Diseases with New South Wales Health. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Richard.
Now, on Remembrance Day, of course, we've been talking about war, but more people died, I understand, during the Spanish influenza epidemic than died during the First World War.
Yeah, they're shocking figures, and something like 50 million people are thought to have died worldwide from that pandemic back in 1918-1919. So you can imagine the effect it had on communities around the world.
As soon as they heard it was coming, they started to take action here, didn't they?
Yeah, look, they heard about the outbreak, probably started in America, but it's a bit unclear, and they heard about outbreak and the big effect it had on the troops on their way over to France and in the trenches. And so the Department of Public Health, as it was then, heard this, were quite worried, and started setting up a range of things to get prepared. 2,500 extra hospital beds. They closed schools and converted them into emergency hospitals in the country. They started installing inhalational sprays and told people about getting ready to stock up on masks, and they started preparing a vaccine.
Now, your equivalent at the time described the disease and the suddenness of the onset.
Yeah, that's right. So people would be perfectly well walking around and then suddenly be struck by what was called an attack of giddiness, muscular weakness and severe headache, even while walking down the street. And people would be, you know, really, really sick a few hours afterwards. And they would also turn this, doctors reported them turning this funny lilac blue colour, and that was because of the pneumonia. Their lungs were full of pus and they couldn't get enough oxygen in, and so they turned this blue colour.
Due to lack of oxygen.
Due to lack of oxygen getting into the tissues, yeah.
But they tried their hardest to stop it coming, didn't they? They put a sea quarantine in.
That's right. So it was extraordinary times, and they both put a sea quarantine. Ships coming particularly from Victoria, where cases had first emerged in Australia, were put in quarantine for 4 days after they left the port just to make sure there was no flu cases on board. And they also put in a land quarantine. They, in fact, closed the border between New South Wales and Victoria and held up people in detention camps for a number of days.
But still those pesky Victorians got through.
they did eventually in late January 1919, the first case was reported from the Randwick Military Hospital, and they said it was a case of suspicious illness in a man who'd arrived after travelling overland from Melbourne into Sydney, and it was said by the doctors that he had all the hallmarks of pneumonic influenza.
We had two waves. It seems that often in the progress of this disease, there are two waves of it.
Yeah, and it's probably because the virus mutated a little bit, and so the first wave that hit Sydney occurred between mid-March and May, and that was bad enough. It killed an estimated 1,800 or so people. But then a second wave, which was much more severe, probably because of the virus mutated, occurred between May and August and killed at least 2,900 people or probably more, including a lot of healthcare workers.
So you add those two together and you get somewhere up towards 5,000, don't you?
Yeah, or even more outside the waves, there are further deaths as well.
A huge number of the population were affected in some way, weren't they?
Yeah, look, it was estimated at the time, and they didn't have the right blood tests and things, but just based on the people who were sick, that 36% of people were sick in Sydney at the time. So that's you can over a third of the community affected by this devastating disease.
You can imagine the effect on the infrastructure, on the ambulance services, on the hospital beds.
Yeah, look, in 1 week in mid-June, 1,315 patients were hospitalised with flu alone in Sydney hospitals, and the reports of ambulance officers, you know, trying to save people who are dying before them in the country and walking with stretchers over through the bush and over sand to try and get people to care.
The restrictions, obviously they as you say, they restricted travel to Melbourne, but they also restricted travel within New South Wales, didn't they?
They did. They, in an attempt to stop it spreading from Sydney into the country, they restricted travel from Sydney into the country for a time. Now, these things didn't work particularly well for very long, but they seemed, at least the things like the sea quarantine, the land quarantine, for a while it seemed to work.
Closing schools, closing churches?
Yeah, look, it's a bit unclear. They did a range of things, closing down public gatherings, getting people to wear masks, a range of things. They even had these chambers that were set up around the city, which were you could sit in for 2 hours and breathe in this what was thought to be a disinfective agent of sulfate of zinc. Now, whether that worked or not, probably there's no evidence it did work. But the range of things were tried, really in desperation to try and stem this very tragic epidemic.
We were talking with the bird flu about the fact that people were affected in strange age groups. This was certainly true of the Spanish influenza as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was unique at the time in that normally in seasonal influenza we see older people, the frail, who are most hard hit by it, the people who die or need hospitalisation. It was very different in 1919. We saw young people, the peak age of death was in the late 30s, and young people much more affected than older people. The lowest death rate, in fact, was in 5 to 9 year olds. So affected little children much less, young adults most, but the elderly less than we'd expect.
They tried to develop a vaccine, didn't they?
They did. They seemed to be quite successful in that. They did used an approach we wouldn't use today. They didn't know it was causing the virus, the influenza at the time. They thought it must have been some bacteria. Of course, it's a virus. They had a number of people who died and took bacterial specimens from the lungs of those people who died at North Sydney Quarantine Station and developed a vaccine out of that. And then they, that was November 1918, and then pretty rapidly started manufacturing and then distributing it to the population in large, large numbers.
Huge numbers, in fact. You had some incredible, I mentioned it before, I think 819,000 inoculations were given.
That's right. So there was a range of different centres set up around the city and around New South Wales, and people were urged to have 2 or 3 doses over 2 or 3 weeks, and people flocked to these vaccine centres, and particularly when they heard of these cases and the deaths occurring after travel from Victoria, people flocked. They also thought it helped not just against flu, but also rheumatism and catarrh. So it was thought to be a bit of a saviour for all sorts of things.
So the vaccine, it didn't work entirely, but it did seem to prevent some serious complications of influenza.
It did. They had some good epidemiologists in the health department at the time, and they were very keen to evaluate what they were doing. And so they sent cards to hospitals in Sydney, and they asked them to fill out, the doctors to fill out information on each patient about whether they were vaccinated, how unwell they were, some of their demographic factors, and in fact were able to then assess whether or not the vaccine worked. And it didn't seem to affect whether or not you got the flu, but it did seem to reduce the severity of the illness, and the people who were vaccinated were less likely to die than those who weren't.
And all these years on, do we understand, because of course this is an interesting question for our own perils with these things, do we understand why this particular virus was so potent?
Well, we don't completely understand, but there's been some research in recent years where they've dug up some Norwegian miners who were buried in the permafrost in the North Pole, and were able to reconstitute the virus from those people all those years ago. Were able to, through new technology, put it back together and reconstruct it, and they were able to see that it's
in a lab, I hope.
In a lab, in a high security lab, and not without ethical oversight. But they were able to find that it was a nasty little virus and had a number of virulent factors associated with it. And remnants of that virus are still around today. It called Havoc, back in 1918, 1919. But the viruses we're seeing today, and even the recent swine flu H1N1 virus, still has sort of the grandparents or virus from 1918.
And are there things that you as a public health official can learn for now from studying this history?
Yeah, look, there's a lot. We have learnt just how bad flu can be and how, suddenly it can emerge out of, nowhere and rapidly spread. And with the recent, this year's H1N1 experience, there are many similarities, including some of the things we tried to do, the wearing of closing of schools in some circumstances, encouraging people when they're close proximity to other people, such as a doctor's waiting room, to wear a mask so they're not spreading their germs to people.
But the main lesson has got to be to isolate Melbourne, surely. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.
That's a pleasure.
Jeremy McAnulty is the Director of Communicable Diseases with New South Wales Health. Another edition of Self Improvement Wednesday. Remember to test yourself out with Jeremy's questions on the website. They're there sitting for you right now. How good will your recall of today's lesson be? Just visit abc.net.au/Sydney/Richard Glover and click on Self-Improvement Wednesday. Next week, we won't be self-improving ourselves. Well, not in the usual way. We'll be broadcasting the New South Wales Primary School's Spelling Bee. So it'll be a kind of spelling self-improvement of a different sort.